Buck 50 Productions, Blackstone Audio presents My Infamous Life, the Autobiography of Mobb Deep's Prodigy by Albert Prodigy Johnson with Laura Checkaway. Read by Prodigy. I dedicate this book to my entire family tree. Kiki, Kizana, Shaka, and Fantasia, I love you. Introduction. June 28th, 2008, Mid-State Correctional Facility, Marcy, New York, 2:30 p.m. Sitting alone at my table in the visiting room, I had to wait until 3 p.m. when visiting hours were over before I could get back to my dorm. I wished I could have gotten up and walked out the prison with Alchemist when he had left, but I had more than 2 years to spend in that 8x10 box before I would be a free man again. This was the second time my friend and producer Alchemist had taken the 4-hour ride up from Manhattan to visit me. He looked good, healthy and focused. The visiting room was packed, around 60 other inmates, their families and friends. During our visit, a few inmates shouted, "Yo, Mobb Deep, what up Alchemist, what up Prodigy?" I told Al how the inmates and the correctional officers had been showing me love and asking for autographs. But after Al left, I sat there, observing everyone around me, and I was reminded that I was just another inmate just like everybody else. Then number 08A1481. My department identification number represents the year which I got locked up. 08. The facility code A for downstate, the prison I was initially in. And then 1481 indicates that I was the 1,481st inmate to get locked up in the prison that year. We were all the same while stuck inside. Even though I didn't want to be in this prison, I deserved to be here. I would hear inmates complain and bitch all day and night about how uncomfortable they were, how unfair the rules and the officers were, and how stressful being locked up was. "Stop crying, do your time," I say to myself. I've done plenty of damage in my days. I've done some wicked, evil, terrible things to people in my past. Shit. The 3.5 years I got was just a slap on the wrist when I think back on all the things I've gotten away with. So I just accepted my circumstances and made the best out of it. Put my time to good use. Prison has given me the time to reflect, look deep inside, realize where I've been, where I am, and where I'm going. I used to be cold and emotionless. I believe the disease I was born with, sickle cell anemia, made me that way. Factor in my environment and the people I surrounded myself with, and yeah, you got the makings of a sinful person. I'm different now, only because I choose to be. I know now that good is the correct way to be. I've been straddling the fence for a number of years, thinking it was okay to do a little bit of evil if I was doing a lot of good. But life doesn't work like that. You have to choose a side. My mind, body, and soul are in excellent condition now. I've never felt so invigorated. I've been in the music industry since I was 16 years old, touring the world, selling millions of albums, groupies, drugs, alcohol, sex, radio, TV, magazines, video, money, jewelry, cars, fashion, rap versus beats, and studios at my disposal nonstop for 17 years straight. Nonstop. 17 years. Do the math. I came to prison when I turned 33. The truth is, I never took the time to stop and mature mentally until now. To step outside my little fast-paced world and see what needed to be adjusted. It's like I was suspended in time. Like I was 16 years old for 17 years. I never grew up. You follow what I'm saying? I am a man now. My hard-headed ass took the long, rocky road to get to this point, but at least I finally made it. Chapter 1. Genesis. Here's a brief family history, because these are the pieces of my puzzle that are most important. Both of my grandparents, on my pop's side, were half black, half Cherokee Indian from the dirty South. Grandpops from Dallas, Texas, and grandmoms from Richmond, Virginia. Bud and Bernice Johnson were big time in their day. Grandmoms, who had a rare combination of dark brown skin, very soft, straight hair, was one of the first cotton club dancers at the world famous nightclub in Harlem. Singer-actress Lena Horne, who also danced at the Cotton Club before her rise to fame, was one of her close friends coming up. In order to be a black person inside that club, your complexion had to be lighted in a brown paper bag, or you had to be part of the entertainment or the help. And that's where my grandparents met. My grandmother told me that my grandfather, who played in the club's band every night, wanted her to stop dancing there. But I don't think she stopped until she was ready. Grandpops was a world-famous jazz musician, now in the big band and jazz hall of fame, who played the saxophone and clarinet and was friends with the major jazz players of that time, Billy Eckstein, Dizzy Gillespie, Gary Bartz, and Frank Foster would come over to the crib and chill. My grandfather wrote his own sheet music and released many albums. He helped teach Quincy Jones to read and write music and toured the world as a member of one of Quincy's first big bands. On weekends as a kid, late at night, Grandpops, or Big Bud, as they called him, would sit me on his lap and try to teach me all these funny-looking music notes while he puffed away on his tobacco pipe. It was a foreign language to me, and I was just too young. Soon after the Cotton Club gig, Grandmoms opened up her own dance school in Jamaica, Queens, the Bernice Johnson Dance School. She started the business in the basement of a house with only a handful of students, but grew so big that she became the first black woman to own a building on Merrick Boulevard and dubbed herself the HNIC, Head Nigga in Charge. In the 70s and 80s, movies like Saturday Night Fever, Fame, Flashdance, Beat Street and Footloose, plus the Michael Jackson and breakdancing and rap music craze, made people really want to dance. Her school was a huge success. But don't let the good fortune, showbiz, and spotlights fool you. My grandparents and parents came up during the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, during major segregation, racism, lynching, and pure hatred for black people. When they gave birth to my father, Bud Johnson Jr., they were very well off money-wise. So growing up, my pops was known as the rich kid in South Jamaica. He got into a lot of fights to prove himself in the streets. Extra wild shit to show people he wasn't no punk. This was my pop's side of the family. Mom's side was different. On my mom's side, my great-great-great-grandpops William Jefferson White and great-great-great-grandmoms Josephine White were 5% black and 95% Irish. Her entire side of the family could pass for Caucasian. Great-great-great-grandpops wasn't a joke. He was a minister who founded and built Morehouse College in the basement of his Baptist church in Augusta, Georgia in 1867. When I found that out, I had to pick my jaw from off the floor. So many famous black men graduated from Morehouse, including Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Samuel L. Jackson, even Spike Lee. William's grandson, my great-grandfather, William J. Shaw, was the secretary of the Republican Central Committee of Georgia from 1926 to 1961, the only black member to hold that political position in Georgia at that time. In 1950, he established the first post office for blacks in Atlanta. Black people had to travel way outside of Atlanta for postal service before that. Finding out about my family tree blew my mind. At first, I was disgusted that I had white blood in me. All I could think about was some white slave master raping my black ancestors. But then I just learned to accept it. My father, Bud Johnson Jr., was born September 14th, 1942, and was raised in my grandparents' Jamaica, Queens house, right behind Godbrewer Boulevard. My mom's, Fatima Frances Johnson, was born July 29th, 1944, and raised in Harlem until age 6, when her family moved to South Jamaica Projects right next to my pops. Her mother's name was Bernie Johnson, similar to my pop's mother, Bernice Johnson. Moms and pops met at my grandma's dance school. Pops was 11, and he loved playing the drums. My mom's was 9, a girl with a sweetheart who loved to sing and dance. She took every class there was. Their puppy love was short-lived. Pops thought he was a player, and Moms left him when she found out he had a handful of girlfriends. At 15, Pops was in a doo-wop group called the Chanters. They had a couple of lukewarm records. Mom's career, on the other hand, must have had Pops wishing he never messed up with her. In 1962, 6 years after my Pops' short run in the music biz, Moms was asked to join a group called the Crystals. Moms was a dime, a 19-year-old light-skinned sister with hazel green eyes who happened to be in the right place at the right time. She had a young son, my older brother, Greg. We have different fathers. And she left him with family so she could hit the road. Moms was big time. The Crystals had a bunch of hit records, including He's a Rebel, The Do Run Run, and Then He Kissed Me, Uptown, and There's No Other Like My Baby. They went on world tours with Diana Ross and the Supremes, Dick Clark, and the like. At one point, she was engaged to Charlie Thomas from the Drifters, but that ain't last. That was just some on the road too long and feeling lonely thing. After being on tour for 3 years straight, Moms and Pops got back together soon after she came back to New York. I guess he really loved her, but he was a wild boy. I know that she loved him. They finally stopped bullshitting and they got married. Now, I was born on November 2nd, 1974, at approximately 9:32 p.m. at Nassau County Medical Center in Hempstead, Long Island.
It's a boy.
By the time I popped out, Hempstead had become almost all black because of what's called white flight. That means that black people started buying property in white neighborhoods and the whites moved out. My grandmother owned 2 houses at that time, one in Hempstead and another in Lakeview, the next town over. Moms, pops, my brother Greg and I moved into my grandma's crib in Lakeview. At less than 1 year old, I was admitted to the hospital for the first time. Bright lights, doctors poking, stabbing, pushing, pulling all over my pain. My mother, my father, relatives' faces bending down, looking at me. Wires connected to my arm with bags full of fluid dripping. All these foggy memories, I guess the trauma I went through, forced me to remember. I wanted to crawl back in my mother's stomach the same way I came out, back to the warm, dark place where I was safe. Who said I wanted to come out anyway? I was fine where I was at. But the witch and wizard doctors cut my mother open and pulled me out like they were conducting some twisted ritual and forced me to take part in this crazy world. There was nothing I could do but be confused and wait. I was diagnosed with sickle cell anemia, SS type. The worst form of sickle cell there is. A painful, hereditary blood disorder that affects only blacks and Latinos. There was very limited information about sickle cell when my parents were planning to have a child. So they were just as confused as me. When I got out the hospital, my parents brought me to my grandma's dance school in Jamaica, Queens. I went from being a science experiment, screaming in a cold, dark hospital alone, to laughing while doing a baby bounce, to the sound of African drums, stomping feet, girls gyrating their bodies to the beat with hundreds of smiling black faces surrounding me. My father was a master African drummer, and my mom's was a dancer. I'd sit in the stroller on the sideline, screaming in a cold, dark hospital alone, to laughing while doing a baby bounce, to the sound of African drums, stomping feet, girls gyrating their bodies to the beat with hundreds of smiling black faces surrounding me. My father was a master African drummer, and my mom's was a dancer. I'd sit in the stroller on the sidelines, or someone would hold me on their lap for a better view, bopping my head to the beat so intensely that my father called me Bophead. Extreme pain to extreme pleasure has been the story of my entire life. That tremendous joy and pain, then joy and pain again, turned me into one little moody motherfucker. My grandmother's dance business was making a lot of money, and she enrolled me into a private preschool at age 4. During winter, waiting for the school bus in the morning, my ankles would start to ache. I hated cold winter mornings. A sickle cell attack would creep up slowly in my ankles, legs, arms, back, stomach, and chest. Sometimes my lips and tongue turned numb, and I knew I was going into a crisis. Crazy, right? When the bus came, I would walk slowly to avoid the pain bum rushing my whole body while the other kids stared through the bus windows, wondering if I was crazy or retarded. But I learned to stay calm and not be embarrassed. I'd rather move slow and look crazy than take the trip to the emergency room. If I moved my body parts fast, it would agitate my sickle cells and cause my pain to increase. But if I moved slowly, and if I was lucky enough, the pain would remain minimal and sometimes even go away. One chilly autumn morning, after walking extra slow to the bus because my pain was sneaking up, I sat in a seat where the sun was beaming hot. The sun shined in that spot the entire ride. I sat very still, without moving a muscle. 15 minutes later, I got off the bus, and the pain was gone. I learned a new trick. The sun's heat actually killed the sickle cells. So every cold morning, I sat in the sun, and I would curse Mother Nature on cloudy, rainy days. I was a very serious child who never got to enjoy life to the fullest like a normal, healthy kid because of my sickle cell. All my boys were into sports and physical fitness, but as bad as I wanted to, I couldn't join in because overworking my body would trigger my pain. Sometimes I'd wake up in severe pain in my stomach and back and constant throbbing like my bones were broken. Pain and I got real close in those early years. Ever since I was born, I was at the hospital at least 4 to 6 times a year with sickle cell, every year. Sometimes for a week, sometimes even up to a month. There's no conventional medical cure for sickle cell. The only treatment was high doses of strong pain medication, like Tylenol with codeine as a child, and Demerol or morphine as I got older. You know, the stuff that they give soldiers when their limbs get blown off in war. Hospitals only allow doses every 4 hours, but I had a high tolerance for medication because my pain was greater than most people's. After an hour, I was screaming in pain again. As a child, I'd be in the emergency room, screaming, squirming on a stretcher like I was about to die. Some evil nurses and doctors would try to shut me up. When they couldn't, they'd call security, wheel me into the back room, and close the door to muffle my screams. Finally, the pain medicine would settle me down. My family would rub the painful spots, trying to soothe me. But after visiting hours were over, it was just me and my comrade Pain. I saw a lot of death and disease in those hospitals. I shared rooms with kids with leukemia whose parents brought them anything they wanted, anything they wished for, because they were on their deathbeds. And it had a profound effect on my mentality. It turned me into a very no-nonsense little kid. As I got older, people always asked, "Are you tired? What's wrong with you? You look angry. Why are you so quiet? Are you upset?" I always hated that shit. No, I'm not tired. No, I'm not angry. Well, maybe a little bit. I'm just not a happy-go-lucky motherfucker. I'm a serious dude because I grew up with a lot of pain, death, and madness. It's rare for me to be smiling and in a good mood. At age 4, I got into a fight with this white kid in the schoolyard for calling me a name I can't even remember. I hopped off the swings and threw a toy teapot at him and missed. He threw it back, and I tried ducking by bending over to the front, but I only ended up using the top of my forehead as a bat for his wild pitch. A big cartoon lump rose up on my forehead. Head bleeding, I saw the scared look on the white boy's face. He didn't mean to hit me in the head. The teacher called my father. After I told my pops the story in the car, he told me to stop crying. "Don't ever duck down when somebody throws something at you," he said. Pops was also a karate sensei, a natural born fighter, and had his own karate school for a few years before I was born. "Just move to the side." After my forehead lump went down, my pops started teaching me karate moves. He enrolled me into a karate class on Jamaica Avenue on 169th Street. My mother didn't like it because of the full body contact, though contact didn't come until second and third degree white belt. My sensei had me cleaning the wood floor with a wet rag while barefoot in my uniform. This was for balance and stamina, like in the movie Karate Kid. Strength training. After 2 months, I got frustrated because I wasn't learning to fight yet. I caught a sickle cell crisis from that cold, wet floor, and Mom said my karate lessons were over. Pops was pissed. "You turning into a punk," he barked. Chest pain overwhelmed me, and I was admitted to Jamaica Hospital. Definitely not the best hospital in Queens. My mom's friend, Dr. Francis, worked there, a black female sickle cell specialist. After Dr. Francis got us in, the doctors informed my mother that I had acute chest syndrome, the sickle cell form of pneumonia. On that visit, I learned to make my presence felt in the emergency room. The squeaky wheel gets the oil. My parents had been trying to coach me on how to conduct myself, but I didn't catch on. "Make noise." Hospital ERs don't give a good goddamn about people with sickle cell. But by the time I hit my teens, going to the ER was like going to war. A sickle cell crisis gets gradually worse as time passes. Normal red blood cells are small round circles that resemble a round piece of candy, like a Surge Mint or a Lifesaver, without the hole in the middle. When going into a sickle cell crisis, normal round red blood cells change to a crescent or a sickle shape. Those sickle-shaped blood cells create a domino effect, interlocking throughout the body, creating clotting and blocking oxygen from flowing through the bloodstream. Loss of oxygen, combined with the loss of blood flow, creates tremendous pain, risk of stroke, bone damage, and other life-threatening consequences. It also causes the immune system to weaken, and it makes it easy to get infections. Acute chest syndrome was no joke for a 4-year-old, and they put me in a big plastic bubble in the intensive care unit. My mother worked during the day, so my grandmother stayed all day and my mom's came at night. One afternoon, when grandmoms came to see me, I was sleeping hard for a few hours. And when she tried waking me up, I wouldn't open my eyes. She called the doctors to check on me, and they said I was just sleeping. She called their superiors, and they said the same. But my grandmother, a southern, strong-willed female from the old school, knew better. She told them that the next person that she was going to call would be her lawyer if they didn't wake me up immediately. They went into a frenzy, finding that all my vital signs were deadly low, and I was slipping in and out of a coma. Grandma saved my life. Moms and grandmoms had a meeting with Dr. Francis to get me out of Jamaica Hospital. Dr. Francis had her own sickle cell clinic in a house on Farmers Boulevard in Jamaica, where I hated going because it meant I was getting a penicillin shot in my butt, one of her remedies for sickle cell. She told moms and grandmoms that Long Island Jewish Hospital was more prestigious than Jamaica Hospital, so I was transferred there for at least a month. The pediatrics unit at Long Island Jewish Hospital had air hockey, foosball, toys, and movies. Jamaica Hospital didn't have a single game or activity. As soon as I felt well enough, I dragged my IV pole down the hallway to the playroom. I was in sick kid heaven. The food was like home cooking. They had brand name cereals, corn pops, sugar smacks, Frosted Flakes. But no matter how much good stuff they had, it was still just a nasty ass hospital. People dying and infectious disease all around. When I got out the following month, it was back to the cold mornings, walking slowly to the school bus. I started getting used to this routine, landing in the hospital at least 6 times between the ages 4 and 5. My parents realized I had another serious problem around that age, pissing in the bed. Most men, let alone rappers, wouldn't dare admit this. But a side effect from drinking tons of water to keep my blood hydrated was waking up with a flood in my bed. "Why didn't you just get up to use the bathroom?" my pops used to yell. I tried to explain it. I was just sleeping when it happened. So how could I get up? But Pops wasn't trying to hear that. He whipped my ass with the belt, thinking I was just scared of the dark and didn't want to walk to the bathroom at night. Grandma's bought this crazy gadget that was supposed to put an end to the bedwetting. A pair of padded underpants with a sensor in the crotch attached to a wire which attached to my pointer finger, powered by a 9-volt battery. As soon as you started pissing, the sensor made the finger attachment vibrate to wake you up. Basically a pair of high-tech diapers. I felt like an idiot, but it was worth a try. The first night, I slept through the vibrating and woke up with the usual flood in my bed. My finger still vibrating when I woke up. We tried a few more nights to no avail. The gadget went into the garbage. In 1980, when I was 6, my grandma's paid for me to go to Woodmere Academy, a private elementary school 5 minutes from West Hempstead in a town called Malvern. The school was 99% white. The only other black kids were my friend Darren and his sister Michelle. Darren smelled like he stepped in shit all the time. It had to be his breath. I never had any racial problems at Woodmere, except one day in the locker room after gym class, a white kid named Max had $40 stolen from his locker and tried to blame me. Max was the first person I'd ever seen with his own credit card. Most people I knew had never even heard of credit cards, but this 7-year-old kid in my school had one. It was American Express. "Did you take my money?" Max looked in my direction. "No." Max and I had a body blow fight in the locker room, punching each other in the stomach, ribs, and chest, and the teachers broke it up. He found his money later and apologized. Why would he accuse me? The only reason I could think of was because I was black. The white kids were cool, though, and a few of the girls had crushes on me. In my first grade class, there was a pretty white girl named Michelle, with long, brownish blonde hair. After graham crackers and apple juice during snack time one day, the whole class went outside for recess. Michelle and I were the last two to leave the classroom. She told me she liked me, put her leg around my waist, and placed my hand on her ass. I was a scared punk. My mind wasn't as advanced yet because I was absent from school so often and didn't hang out in Lakeview Park like the other kids my age due to my sickle cell. Being hospitalized for weeks and months caused me to miss out on the birds and the bees activities. I wasn't ready for Michelle's advances, but she was all over me. I think it had a lot to do with my grandmother's car. Sometimes, grandmas would drop me off at school in her brand spanking new Cadillac with a burgundy pinstripe on the side and the burgundy leather seats. Those white kids' parents dropped them off in Mercedes-Benzes and Rolls Royces, so we gotta show them that your family got money too, she said. Michelle saw me getting out the car one morning and stared, starry-eyed. Grandmoms knew how to make a grand entrance. She lived, breathed, ate, slept, and shit show business. The world was her stage, and I learned a lot from her flashy actions. She would tell me about how she came up from Southside Jamaica to become the first black woman with her own building on Merrick Boulevard. Then hers was the first black family in Hempstead, Long Island, to build their own house. Chaka, you gotta